This morning we're going to be studying from Malachi chapter 3, verses 7 through 12, and our subject is a call to total obedience. I suppose it ought not to surprise me, but I must frankly confess to you that it often does. I hardly ever speak to a young person who doesn't assure me, if they're a Christian, that one of the desires of their life is to have the blessing of God upon them. I frankly can never recall sitting with a young couple whom I'm working with, preparing them for marriage in our pre-marriage counseling course, and ever encounter a couple who would hesitate to say that one of the deep desires in their life is to have the blessing of God upon their marriage. I frankly can never remember speaking to a Christian parent who hesitated to affirm that one of the desires they had as a parent was to experience the blessing of God upon their home and upon every one of their children. I frankly can never remember ever speaking to a Sunday school teacher or to an elder or to a deacon or to a preacher who hesitated to say that one of the deep desires in his life or her life was to experience the blessing of God upon their service for the Lord. The thing that has astounded me so often is that that is almost virtually unanimous in terms of desire on the part of God's people. The blessing is sought by us all. And yet, the tragedy seems to be that the pathway is missed by so many. I suppose that that ought not to surprise me either. I suspect that it's been characteristic of every generation of God's people down through the ages. It surely was characteristic of the people of God in the last days of the Old Testament era. There was no doubt that they sought the blessing of God. There was also no doubt that they missed the pathway to that blessing. God raises up Malachi, his messenger, and Malachi appears upon the scene to point the children of Israel in the direction of the pathway that leads to the experience of the blessing of God. What is that pathway? A few years ago, J. Hudson Taylor, the founder of the China Inland Mission, wrote, "God cannot, will not, does not bless those who are living in disobedience. But only let us set out in the path of obedience. And at once, before one stone is laid upon another, God is eager, as it were, to pour out his blessing." I suspect that what Hudson Taylor is telling us is simply that the pathway to overwhelming blessing in the life of a Christian is the pathway of total obedience. In spite of all of the experiences of the children of Israel through the Old Testament, they hadn't learned that lesson. And so God raises up his messenger, Malachi. And Malachi appears upon the stage, and he issues to the people of Israel a call to total obedience. Following again the form of Malachi's typical writing, verse 7 begins with an affirmation from God. That affirmation, if you will look at it carefully, consists of three elements. First of all, there is a charge, and the charge is simply this: "From the days of your fathers you have turned aside from my statutes and have not kept them." If you will remember, last week we concluded our study with verse 6, where Malachi touches upon one of the great attributes of God. He expounds the immutability of the Lord, that he is unchangeable. Because he is unchangeable, Israel has not been consumed. God has been true to his promises. He's been faithful to his covenant. God is changeless. Now, as Malachi, the spokesman of God, moves into the next section, it's interesting that virtually the same characteristic is mentioned in behalf of the children of Israel. They too are changeless. They are unchanging. But notice the area in which their changelessness centers. From the days of your fathers, you have turned aside from my statutes, and you have not kept them. The charge that God raises against the children of Israel is that they have been consistently disobedient. They have persisted to disobey. Their obedience has been consistently incomplete. The charge, then, is a charge of incomplete, persistent disobedience. Following the charge, there comes the appeal. The Lord continues and says, "Return to me." That appeal is a warm appeal, isn't it? It's the kind of appeal a friend would give to a traveler who has missed the pathway that will take him to his desired destination. And out of compassion and love, the friend would come to him, touching him on the shoulder, and urge him to return to this pathway and to take this roadway, because this is the roadway that's going to lead to the blessing. It's the kind of appeal that a good friend would give to a soldier who has deserted his army. As the good friend would come and tap his soldier friend on the shoulder, he would urge him to return to his allegiance to the military, to return to his pathway of obedience to his commanding general. He would urge him to return to that pathway, because it's in that pathway that he's going to experience the commendation of his authorities. It's the kind of appeal that a good friend issues to a husband who abandons his wife and his children. That good friend comes to the husband, tapping him on the shoulder, and he urges him to return to his responsibilities, to return to a commitment to the vows that he made on the day of his marriage. That's the same kind of appeal that Malachi is issuing as he speaks for God. The Lord, through Malachi, is saying to the people of Israel, "Return to me. Come back to your allegiance to me. Return to your commitment to me. Return to the pathway of obedience to me. Remember your responsibilities. Remember your promises. Remember the covenant commitments that you've made. Return to me," is the appeal that God makes through Malachi. And then the affirmation is followed with a promise. And the promise is this: "And I will return to you." That's a very warm promise, isn't it? Especially in the light of the day of the Lord that we have just studied in the first few verses of Malachi chapter 3. The day of the Lord is coming, has announced Malachi, and that day of the Lord is going to begin with judgment at the house of God. In the light of the impending wrath of God that is hovering on the horizons for the nation of Israel, it is an exceedingly encouraging promise that God makes. If you will return to me, I'll return to you. It's a promise that implies that somehow God has left them. And we understand from the previous verses that we have studied that that is precisely what has happened. God has left them in terms of his practical, active involvement in bringing blessing into their lives. God has left them. And he promises that if you return to me, I'll return to you. It's a rather encouraging promise too, isn't it? Because what it implies is that in spite of all that Israel has done, they haven't turned or passed the point of no return. If you return to me, says God through Malachi, I'll return to you. You haven't yet passed the point of no return. I think that one of the things that has been most encouraging to me in my life as a Christian is to realize that there is no such thing as a point of no return for a child of God. I am so thankful that no matter how far a Christian shall wander from a pathway of obedience, I am so grateful that no matter how far a child of God shall fall from his commitments and his promises to God, that he never passes the point of no return. If we confess our sin, says the New Testament, if we confess that sin, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sin and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. The affirmation, then, that comes from God through Malachi to Israel involves three elements. There's the charge of persistent disobedience. There's the appeal to return to a pathway of obedience. And there's the promise that if you do return, then I'll return to you and give to you the promised blessings that are part of the inheritance and the covenant. Typical again, with Malachi style, the affirmation is followed by the interrogation. And so, at the end of verse 7, the children of Israel respond. In their self-righteousness, in their arrogance, in their pride, they respond by saying, "How shall we return?" In effect, what they're really doing is saying, "How have we departed? Why should we return? Because wherein have we left? You charge us with disobedience? In what way have we disobeyed? You urge us to return? In what area ought we to return?" And so God, responding to the question of the children of Israel, immediately pick up their question and follows with his refutation. And in verses 8 through 12, you have God's refutation of the interrogation raised by the children of Israel. These four verses are among the four most treasured verses in all of the Old Testament. You probably have not been a Christian long until you came across these four verses. If you have attended a Bible-teaching church many times, you've heard messages that have centered upon the teaching of these four verses. I would think that probably, apart from some of the passages in the Psalms, these four verses are among the best known and they're among the most loved verses in all of the Old Testament scriptures. What we want to do is look at them carefully this morning, because it seems to me that our familiarity with these verses sometimes has led to contempt and certainly has led to a great deal of misconception. Let's look carefully then. What actually happens in verses 8 through 12 is this. God now moves from the general to the specific. And he takes the charge and the appeal and the promise. And now he makes those three elements specific. So, for example, in verses 8 and 9, the charge is specified. Notice how he begins. "Will a man rob God?" That's a strange question, isn't it? Just blot out everything else in the verse in your mind for just a moment and consider that question. Could anything be more ludicrous than a man or a woman, college student, a high school student, robbing God? You can steal from a storekeeper because you can do something behind his back that he doesn't notice. You can steal from a 4 or 5 year old kid on the street because you can beat him up. But will a man rob God? To think that we can rob God is to think that we can overpower God. It's to think that we can do something that God doesn't notice. It's to think that somehow we can manipulate and negotiate with God. Will a man rob God? Surely nothing is more ludicrous. Nothing is more futile. Nothing is more stupid than to think that a puny man, to think that a frail woman, to think that a student could actually rob God. But notice, the appeal now, or the charge, is specified. "You are robbing me," he declares. They again, of course, respond with their expressed doubt. "But you say, how have we robbed you?" And now the charge is declared and demonstrated. "In tithes and contributions," says the New American Standard Bible. The King James Version says, "in offerings." Actually, then, what God moves to do is to demonstrate specifically to the children of Israel how they have been robbing God, how they've been doing it. First of all, in tithes. The tithe was a very important part of the Old Testament covenant. When the children of Israel entered into a covenant relationship with God at Mount Sinai, one of their responsibilities was to tithe. Literally, the word tithe means a tenth. They were to give to God a tenth of all of their grain. They were to give to God a tenth of all of their fruit. They were to give to God a tenth of all of their flocks. And they were to give to God a tenth of all of their cattle. So from their produce, as well as from their livestock, from four different areas, they were to give to God a tenth. That tenth or tithe belonged to God. It's very important for us in our era to understand that the tithe, of course, obviously then, to an Israelite, was much, much more than 10%. Many Bible students calculate that it was somewhere around 30 or perhaps higher percent. They were to give a tenth of each of those four areas, and that belonged to God. That was God's possession. Now, says God, you're robbing me. You're not giving me what belongs to me. You're not giving me what is your responsibility to me. You're defrauding me of the tithe. The tithes were an important part of the religious life of the Israelites because the tithes were the means whereby the priesthood was sustained. And so as the Israelites brought their tithes to the temple or to the tabernacle, those tithes were used to sustain the priests and the Levites who were involved in the service of the temple and the tabernacle. He says, not only have you robbed me in tithes, but you've also robbed me in offerings. Now, the word that is used for offerings in the Hebrew text here is a technical word. And it is a word that is used for a very special kind of offering. It's called the heave offering, or if you like, the wave offering. There was one offering that the children of Israel brought, which was called the peace offering. Part of that peace offering was taken, and it was lifted up before God, and it was waved, like this. And after it was heaved, or waved before God, that part of the peace offering was set apart, and it became the means whereby the priesthood lived. So both the tithes and the offerings involved in the defrauding were the means whereby the servants of God, the priesthood in Israel, survived. What they were doing was they were robbing God, because in robbing God, because in depriving him of the, depriving the priests rather, of the tithes and the offerings, they were actually robbing God. It shows, first of all, doesn't it, the attitude that the children of Israel had toward the priesthood. One of the reasons why they were not bringing their tithes and bringing their offerings was because they had lost their respect for the priesthood. After all, why should we bring part of our livestock and part of our produce to feed the priests who are serving in the temple? Somehow they had lost their respect for the priesthood. And so they did not bring their tithes. They had lost their respect for the representatives of God. And so they were not bringing their offerings. And somehow behind their failure to bring their tithes and offerings, there's an indication of a lack of respect they had for the servants of God. I think perhaps the important lesson is to see that in their failure to bring their tithes and their offerings to the servants of God, what they were actually doing is robbing God. They didn't look at it that way. The way they looked at it was that those priests no longer were worthy of their tithes and their offerings. After all, they're a bunch of scamps. And that is why many of the Israelites looked at the priests in the days of Malachi. They weren't worthy of their food, and they weren't worthy of their sacrifices. And so, because of their lack of respect for them, they had held back in their tithes and their offerings. God says, what you're really doing in not bringing your tithes and your offerings to the temple is you are really robbing me. Now, will a man rob God? Can a man rob God and get away with it? Well, look at what the next part of the verse says. You have robbed me in tithes and in offerings. Verse 9 goes on and says, you are cursed with a curse, for you are robbing me, the whole nation of you. Now, in order to understand that verse, I must ask you to turn back in your Bibles to Deuteronomy chapter 28. In Deuteronomy 28, Moses is rehearsing with the new generation of Israelites just before they go into the promised land, the covenant arrangement that has been made between Israel and God. In essence, what Moses is saying to the children of Israel is this: if you obey God, God will bless you. If you disobey, then God will curse you. Now notice what it says, for example, in verse 38 of Deuteronomy 28. Here is a description of some of the cursings that will fall upon them if they disobey their covenant commitment, which involved the tithe and the offering. Verse 38, you shall bring out much seed to the field, but you shall gather in little, for the locust will consume it. You shall plant and cultivate vineyards, but you shall neither drink of the vine nor gather the grapes, for the worm will devour it. You shall have olive trees throughout your territory, but you shall not anoint yourself with the oil, for your olives shall drop off. You shall have sons and daughters, but they shall not be yours, for they shall go into captivity. The cricket shall possess all your trees, the produce of your ground. The alien who is among you shall rise over you higher and higher, but you shall go down lower and lower. He shall lend to you, but you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you will be the tail. So all these curses shall come on you and pursue you and overtake you until you are destroyed because you would not obey the Lord your God by keeping his commandments and his statutes which he commanded you. And they shall become a sign and a wonder on you and your descendants forever because you did not serve the Lord your God with joy, with a glad heart, for the abundance of all things. The remarkable thing about Deuteronomy chapter 28 is precisely this. Exactly what God predicted would come upon the children of Israel if they disobeyed has come upon them for their disobedience in the days of Malachi. They are not the head of the nations, they are the tail of the nations. They are not over nations, they're suppressed by nations. They're not living in prosperity, they're living in poverty. They're planting, but they're not harvesting. And they're living in destitution. They are politically oppressed and they're economically depressed. Now, the remarkable thing about Malachi's generation is this. They are experiencing precisely what God said would happen in Deuteronomy chapter 28 if they didn't obey. If they didn't obey in the tithe. If they didn't obey in the offering. Will a man rob God? Friend, the answer is categorically no. You can't rob God and get away with it. You can try, but there is no way that a man can rob God and get away with that. The prophet or the apostle Paul in the New Testament writes, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever you sow is exactly what you will reap." It seems remarkably easy in our day and age today to rob God of our money, doesn't it? As a matter of fact, the latest statistics that I have indicate that only 2.9% of gross earnings in America are given to charity. The average church member gives $41 a year to his church and $1 a year to foreign missions. That is the average across America. What is happening, of course, you see, is that men and women think they're robbing God. Now, it's important for us to understand, and I do need to take just a little parenthesis at this point to establish, that as far as I can understand, at least, the tithe is not an obligation to a Christian in the New Testament era. The tithe was part of the responsibility of an Israelite under the Mosaic covenant. You and I, as Christians in the New Testament era, are not living under the Mosaic covenant. We do not take our offerings to Jerusalem and offer sacrifices. We do not observe the Sabbath day. We are not living under the Mosaic covenant. We are living under the New Covenant. And under the New Covenant, it is never stated as an obligation upon a Christian to tithe. As far as I'm concerned, that is an area of Christian liberty. A Christian may choose to tithe if he wishes, if she wishes, but there is certainly no biblical basis for me to put upon you this morning the responsibility and the guilt of tithing. That is not an injunction in the New Testament for the New Testament Christian. We have no obligation to tithe. That was the obligation and responsibility of the Christian in the Old Testament era. As he tithes, God promised to him material blessings: his flocks, his herds, his fruit, and his grain. He promised him material blessings, and he promised him political blessings. His nation would be exalted above the other nations. In the New Testament era, we are not obligated to tithe. We are instructed to give as the Lord prospers us. We are instructed to give as we purpose in our hearts. We are instructed to give liberally and cheerfully. That is our responsibility. As we recognize that responsibility under the New Testament era, it seems remarkably easy to defraud God in the giving of our money, doesn't it? $1 in a snack bar seems so little, but $1 on an offering plate seems a great deal. A young man will take a favorite girl out on a Saturday night for a special dinner and for a musical program, and he will spend $20. But a whole year can go by without him giving $20 to the Lord. A businessman or a homemaker can go out and spend $50 or $100 or $200 on a suit of clothing. But $50 and $100 and $200 to the Lord seems like such a gigantic amount. Will a man rob God? It seems so easy today, doesn't it, to defraud God in the giving of our money. And yet, be not deceived, friend. God is not mocked. Whatever you and I sow is precisely what we'll reap. It's important for us to understand that under the New Testament covenant, the promises do not involve material blessing. God does not promise to prosper our business. He does not promise to prosper us politically as a nation. There is no promise of prosperity in the material realm. The promises for obedience to God in the New Testament covenant are promises that are spiritual promises. He promises to give us peace. He promises to fill our hearts with joy. He promises to give us enablement and power and blessing in our life. The promises are spiritual blessings. One of the reasons why we are in such spiritual poverty across America is because we're robbing God of what belongs to Him in the money that He has entrusted to us. It seems so easy to rob God of the time that He gives us, when all of our time, just like all of our money, belongs to Him. A little bit of time to God seems like so much time. When so much time given to our business, or so much time given to a girlfriend, or so much time given to a recreation seems so little. So easy today to think that we can defraud God of art, of our time, which all of which really belongs to Him. But friend, don't be deceived. God isn't mocked. Whatever you and I sow, that's exactly what we reap in spiritual blessings in our lives. Seems so easy, doesn't it, to rob God of the spiritual gifts that He's entrusted to us. We understand that as Christians He's given to us spiritual gifts. Those gifts are given for the profit and the benefit of the church of Jesus Christ. It seems so easy to rob God of that gift. It belongs to Him. It's been given by Him, for Him, and for His people. seems so easy to defraud God of that gift and to hold it back and not to invest it in the service of God, not to become involved in the work of God. But don't be deceived, friend. God is never mocked. Whatever you and I sow is precisely what we reap in spiritual blessings in our lives. It seems so easy to rob God of our bodies, doesn't it? Our bodies are His property. He's given us those bodies. The Spirit of God has come down to indwell those bodies. Seems so easy to rob God of that body and to use that body for things that I want to use it for that don't please Him. It seems so easy to abuse that body and to misuse that body. Seems so easy to rob God, doesn't it? And yet, you don't rob God. Whatever a man sows, that's precisely what a person reaps in the spiritual dimensions of his life. You're robbing me, says God. And you're robbing me specifically in areas that belong to me. But I want you to understand that you're not really getting away with it. You're not really getting away with it, because the very circumstances in which you find yourself, they demonstrate that what you're sowing is precisely what you're reaping. For the children of Israel, what they were reaping materially was the consequence of their disobedience. For many of us, in terms of our families, in terms of our marriages, in terms of our peace of mind, in terms of the power of God in our ministry, what we are sowing is a direct consequence of our incomplete obedience to God. Now, if we're Christians, we obviously become just a little resentful at this point in our life. Because if you're a concerned Christian, you say, but Bill, that's really not fair for you to put that load upon me, because actually I do give some of my money to God. I do give some of my time to the Lord. I am involved in some areas of Christian service. I do know that my body belongs to God. I am concerned about giving to God some areas of my life. You see, that's exactly the mistake, friend. That is one of the most serious pitfalls you can ever fall into in your life, right there. That's exactly how the children of Israel were responding. As Malachi, the spokesman of God, speaks to them, they were saying, but just a minute, God, we are bringing some of our tithes to the temple. We are bringing some of those offerings to God. Watch. Now the appeal is specified. The appeal generally was to return to me. Notice what the specific appeal is at the beginning of verse 10. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, so that there may be food in my house. That's the appeal. It's to bring the whole tithe. Now, if I understand the text correctly, what is happening then in the children of Israel's experience is precisely what happens in my life over and over again. There was a partial obedience to God. They were bringing some of the tithe to God. They were bringing some of the offerings to God, and they somehow thought that by partial obedience, they were obeying. That's like a half-truth. A half-truth is a lie. That's what partial obedience is. Partial obedience is disobedience. And so the appeal is, bring the whole tithe into the storehouse. The storehouses were lean-to shelters, three stories high, that were built on three sides of the temple. And that is where the grain and the produce and the flocks and the herds were brought, and they were stored in those lean-to shelters for appropriate times of sacrifice and for the eating of the priesthood. He says, bring the whole tithe. Bring everything that belongs to me. Bring your total responsibility to me into the storehouse. The appeal, then, you see, is really an appeal to total obedience. And as I meditate upon this, I find that it's tremendously relevant to me in my life. Because I recognize that all of my money belongs to God. I recognize that in this New Testament era, all of my time belongs to Him. I recognize that all of my spiritual gift is His.
I recognize that my entire body is His. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I recognize that all that I am and all that I have, it's His. And so the call to obedience is really a call to total obedience. And it's really an appeal to God's people of every era to bring all that they are and all that they have and to lay it down before God and say, Lord, there it is. I'm going to totally obey You. I'm going to give You all that belongs to You. I'm going to acknowledge all of my responsibility. It's an appeal to total obedience. Friend, that is devastating in our lives as Christians, isn't it? I'm so thankful that Malachi, the messenger of God, goes on and specifies the promise. Notice how the text concludes. He says, you bring the whole tithe into the storehouse. Now what's going to happen? Test me now in this. First of all, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you a blessing until there is no more need. That's material blessing. Now we do not have that promise in our day and age. God does not promise material blessing to His people. There is no promise of that. Godly Christians are in financial need. God promises to supply our needs, but He does not promise prosperity, material and physical prosperity. There are many of God's holy, righteous people who are in refugee camps this morning. They are oppressed under a yoke of oppressive government. They are suffering in Cambodia, in North Korea, in many of the countries of the world, and they are God's choice people. God does not promise material blessing, but for us His promise is spiritual blessing. The application is, bring to me all that I own. Bring to me all that you owe to me, and see if I will not open the windows of heaven and pour out a spiritual blessing upon you that will be so great that you won't even be able to contain it. The blessing in the lives of your children, the blessing in your marriages, the blessing in that Sunday school class, the blessing in your teaching, the blessing in your witnessing. Just test me. The blessing in your own conscience, the blessing in your own heart, the peace of mind. Just test me. Bring it all to me. Total obedience. And I'll open the windows of heaven and I'll pour out a blessing that you can't even contain. He goes on and says in the next verse, then I will rebuke the devourer for you so that it will not destroy the fruits of the ground. That's a reference to the locust that we referred to back in Deuteronomy 28. Nor will your vine in the field cast its grapes. God is going to rebuke the locust from devouring the crops. He is going to prevent the vines from having miscarriages out on the field. Both of those were explicit curses mentioned in Deuteronomy 28 for disobedience. And then finally he says, and all the nations will call you blessed, because instead of being the tail, as Deuteronomy 28 predicted and as they were experiencing, instead of being the tail of the nations, you shall be a delightful land. I will exalt you above all of the nations of the earth, and all of the nations shall call you blessed. You see, what Malachi is really saying as he speaks for God is this: the pathway, friend, to overwhelming blessing in our lives as Christians is the pathway of total obedience to God. Obey me. Totally. And I'll bless you. Sometimes that blessing is material. The story is told of Charles Haddon Spurgeon on one occasion leaving his great preaching post in England to go and visit three great Baptist churches in order to raise £300 needed for his ministry. After his preaching engagements, he had accumulated the £300. He was about to return to his home. And as he was in his bed that night, trying to go to sleep, God seemed to be speaking to his heart. And he said, Spurgeon, I want you to give that money to George Mueller for his work among the orphans. And Spurgeon entered into a little bit of an argument with God. He said, but God, you know that I need those £300 for the work back in my home church. And it just seemed to be that he couldn't find peace in his heart and he couldn't go to sleep at night until finally he said, okay, God, I'll give you those £300 and I'll take them to Mueller in the morning. The next morning, he arrived at the orphanage in Bristol where Mueller was. He found him praying. He touched him on the shoulder and said, George, God has spoken to my heart and he's given me a concern to give you these 300 pounds. Mueller got up off his knees and he said, bless you, Spurgeon. I've just been praying for those 300 pounds. We need them now. And Spurgeon left and he went back home. He says when he arrived home and came to his desk, there on his desk was an envelope. And it contained 300 guineas. Now, I don't know a whole lot about English money. Dr. Groom will have to check me up here. But from my reading, at least, he said, as he looked at it, there were 300 guineas. And he said, thank you, God. You have not only given me back my 300 pounds, but you've given me 300 shillings interest on it. And that's exactly how God sometimes works in the lives of his people. Sometimes, complete obedience does lead to material blessing, but not always. That is not the promise of God for the New Testament Christian. It does involve spiritual blessing, though. Adoniram Judson was a great man of God. When he graduated from seminary, one of the great churches in Boston gave him a call to their pastorate. His mother and sister were delighted because it meant that he would be able to live close at home. But Judson declined that call. Shaking his head, he said, my work is not here. God is calling me beyond the seas. To stay here, even to serve God in this ministry, I feel would only be partial obedience. And I could not be happy in that. Counting the cost, Judson left home. He went to Burma, became a great missionary for God. The church in Boston still stands today, very rich, very powerful. But as a result of Judson's complete obedience to God, there are 50,000 Christians in Burma. And his influence has spread all around the world among God's people. You see, friend, the pathway to overwhelming blessing in the lives of God's people is a pathway of total obedience to God. When Moody used to conduct his services, at the end of his services or sometimes early in them, he would give opportunity for people to stand up and give public testimony. On one occasion, an anonymous individual stood up and he said that he did not know much about the Bible. And he did not know much about Bible doctrine. But he said, one thing I am determined to do, and that is to trust and obey. The man who was conducting that part of the program for Moody that night was D.B. Towner. He listened to those words, and he thought to himself, that's a wonderful commitment, determination to make. Sometime thereafter, he was talking to John Samus, a Presbyterian minister, and he said, you know, one day at one of Moody's services, I heard a man give a lovely little testimony where he said that his determination in his life was to trust and obey. And John Samus clicked, and he said, you know, that really is the heart of the Christian life. And very shortly thereafter, he sat down at his table, and he wrote the words that we have sung. When we walk with the Lord in the light of his word, what a glory he sheds on our way. While we do his good will, he abides with us still and with all who will trust and obey. Not a shadow can rise, not a cloud in the skies, but his smile quickly drives it away. Not a doubt nor a fear, not a sigh nor a tear can abide while we trust and obey. One day, Samus was preaching on the West Coast, and as sometimes song leaders are inclined to do, the song leader thought that he would honor Samus by singing this hymn just before he spoke. But again, as song leaders sometimes are inclined to do, he suggested that they sing the first, second, and fourth verses. And that just caused Samus to go right through the roof. He was a little fellow, white hair, little goatee. He was sitting over on that side of the platform, and he rushed over to the pulpit and he took the microphone from the song leader and he said, don't miss verse 3. That's why I wrote the hymn. Verse 3 says, but we never can prove the delights of his love until all on the altar we lay. For the favor he shows and the joy he bestows are for them who will trust and obey. Let's bow in prayer, shall we?